Good morning. So I'll say from the start, this lesson is about a year in the making for me. Something that I've been thinking about a lot recently. And it might just be because of the phase of life that I'm in now that I'm a few years into my 30s. But in the last year, I've had a lot of conversations with people. We have some serious doubts in their faith. Have a lot of questions about their faith. And some have made some pretty serious changes in their life because of those doubts in their faith. Some have even publicly announced that they no longer have faith, or at least faith in God. Actually, recently, some people I knew in college publicly renounced their faith in God. They wrote what would have amounted to pages if it were handwritten. They made a Facebook post updating everyone about where they are now, where their faith is or lack thereof, and how they got there. And it was really sad to read. And it only got worse in the comment section, as it always does, because As some people who profess to be Christians in their comments actually applauded these people's renouncing of God. I hope I just misunderstood what they read, or maybe they wrote something that they didn't really mean. But then others expressed the same feelings of doubt and expressed the same feelings of not having faith anymore. So this has been on my mind a lot. But one thing that crossed my mind is I can only imagine how God must feel. Because, you know, God doesn't need a Facebook post to know how we're doing as far as our faith is concerned. God knows our hearts, which in some ways we view that as a really comforting thing. In other ways, that should terrify us, because where are we in our faith? And that's the question that I want to pose this morning. God looks out at every single one of us and He knows our hearts. But we need to look inside our hearts and ask ourselves, where is our faith? So I want to pose this question, where is your faith? And then hopefully provide some things to do when you find out where it is. But I want to make clear that this is not a sermon that's going to address like evidences. I'm not going to talk about like a case for God as our creator, a case for Christ as our savior, or even give church history and why we practice things the way we do here. That's not really the point of the lesson. I have two main points that I want to address. And the first one is, and I want to make this clear, if you have serious doubts in your faith in God, talk to somebody. If there's one thing I want to make clear, it's that you need to talk to somebody about your faith. And the second thing is, if you're strong in your faith, you need to talk to somebody. You need to create an environment in which one who does doubt feels comfortable enough expressing those doubts. Now, other points will be made as we go throughout the lesson, but those are certainly the two that I want to drive home this morning. But before we can actually assess where our faith is, I do find it important for us to establish what is faith in the first place. And I think most of us here this morning have a pretty good idea as to what faith is. And even though it might be a pretty familiar passage, I don't think we can biblically define what faith is without going to Hebrews 11 and verse 1. And it says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So what is faith? Well, it's always helpful when you find a passage that starts with faith is. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. So that means faith is the foundation of hope. So whatever it is that you have hope in, faith is that foundation of that. Well, what do we have hope in but a hope in salvation ultimately? A hope in an eternal life with God. Well, how do we have that hope? Well, it comes from faith. That hope of being saved is in our faith. So faith is a very serious thing. So as we're assessing where our faith is, understand that you're approaching a very important topic. But faith also serves as the conviction of things not seen, the evidence of things not seen. So, when it comes to faith, or when it comes to things that we cannot see, we fool ourselves into thinking that, well, maybe if I just lay out all of these things that I can see, all of these evidences, well, then I can have faith. Well, faith isn't founded on all of these things that we can see directly in front of us. Actually, faith is the evidence for what we cannot see. Now, this isn't to say that we don't have evidences for things that we believe, but we can't, we fool ourselves into thinking that we can have everything laid out in front of us, and then we can believe. In 1990, Paul Simon wrote a song called Proof. Now, he wasn't addressing this topic at all in that song, but he has a line in that song which I've always found fascinating, a line that I think sums up all of a human desire that all of us have, an impossible human desire. He says, "Faith is an island in the setting sun, but proof is the bottom line for everyone." Well, my first issue with this line is that it implies that these two things are mutually exclusive. Meaning, if you have faith, it's without any proof. And if you're looking for proof, you do that without any faith. And I don't think that's true. However, I do understand the sentiment here. He's expressing a desire that I think every single one of us have. I mean, how great would that be if we had proof for every single belief that we had? That I could just believe something and there would be proof for it. Or proof for every decision that we make, knowing that every decision that I have made, it is the right one. And I know it because I can look at every single proof that leads me there. But is that possible? Hebrews 11 and verse 6 says, "Without faith, it is impossible to please God." And I'm certainly not going to stand up here and refute that statement, but I want to pose that I think that not only is it impossible to please God without faith, I don't think you can please yourself without faith. Everything we do in life has some sort of ounce of faith in it. Most every single act we make. The context of the song that Paul Simon wrote was actually about a man who's about to get married. And he repeats this phrase that faith is an island in the setting sun. I don't want to just have faith that my wife is going to be faithful to me. I want proof. Proof is the bottom line for us all. Well, I'm looking out in the audience, and there's a lot of married people here. I've been married for 10 years now. And even though even though before I got married, I had plenty of evidence that Hannah was going to be faithful to me. When I said I do, there's a leap of faith involved there, right? Certainly on her behalf. When we make those bold statements like that, there's faith in that. But just take your drive to the church building here this morning. You left your house. You locked up your house, but still, you left out of faith that it wouldn't be robbed while you're gone, or out of faith that it would actually, you know, still be yours by the time you got home. You drove on the right side of those yellow lines on the road in faith that the people on the other side are going to do the same thing, right? You parked your car in the parking lot, or some lot, And you walked into the building with some sort of faith that the car is going to be there when you get outside. Those of you with kids, you dropped your kids off in the classroom with some sort of faith that they were going to be there when you got back. We act upon faith all the time. So we cannot live without some sort of faith. I hope that's clear. But the Bible actually talks about that. Go ahead and open up to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. I want to look at a couple verses there. Ecclesiastes talks a lot about knowing. And there's a lot of things that Solomon is able to observe in life, and he can say that he knows. But then the next chapter, he's like, but I've kind of observed the opposite of that too, and I'm not actually sure about this. But he does say this. He can affirm this in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, beginning in verse 11. He says, "I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all." Verse 12, "Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time, when it suddenly falls on them. There are just things in life we cannot know. So what does that mean? Does that mean we just sit there and wait to find something that we actually can know and then we jump on that? Well, no, we can't do that. We operate on faith all the time. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Well, what I want to do this morning, as we assess our faith, as we assess specifically our faith in God, I want you to look at this little spectrum of sorts. I think all of us kind of fit on this spectrum to some degree, where on one end we have doubts, maybe even life-altering doubts, where these doubts are so strong that I now am going to live a different life as a result. And then on the other end, we have faith that makes you well, to use the language of Jesus. But the truth is, though, I think we move around on this spectrum, perhaps year to year, month to month. Maybe some people are in a place where they're going back and forth day to day. Go ahead and turn to Mark chapter 9. There's a story in Mark chapter 9 that talks about those who have faith, but in the same instance, don't. I think there's an important passage there when we're thinking about faith. In this passage, there's a man who has a son, and that son has a demon. And this man brings his son to the disciples so that they might cast out that demon, but the disciples are unable to do that. And so then they bring him to Jesus, and they explain this incident to Jesus. And the father says, "Jesus, if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." To which Jesus looks at the man and says, "If you can? All things are possible to him who believes." So essentially, Jesus is telling the man, "Hey, you want your son to feel better? Well, that is totally contingent on your faith. That is completely contingent on how much you believe." That's tough. If the life of my son depended on my faith, I would be pretty fearful. But take a look at what the man says. The man responds and he says, "I do believe. Help my unbelief." What does Jesus do next? Well, there's a little bit of unbelief there. Come back when you have full belief. Well, no. He heals the boy. He heals him. Even in this declaration of a lack of faith, you see him pleading for more. "Jesus, help my unbelief." So is it wrong of us to have doubts? Well, in some cases, yes. In some ways, yes. Jesus calls out a lack of faith, but he shows us how we can have more. And what you see in the man is that he wants to have faith. "Help my unbelief." I think we all have doubts, and certainly they're to varying degrees. But our constant prayer needs to be, "Help my unbelief." The first thing that I want to do is address those who are more on this side of this life-altering doubt. And then at the end, briefly, we'll talk about those who are on the other end of that spectrum. But I want to pose three things to help those who are more on this life-altering doubt side. I think the first thing that you need to do, you need to establish what are your doubts. You can't be hovering around in this vague area of, "Well, I'm not exactly sure what's going on." No, you need to think about that. Establish what your doubts are. Earlier, we referenced Hebrews 11 and verse 6. It says, "And without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him." It's interesting. The rest of this verse here in verse 6, it kind of gives you this general definition of what faith in God is. Faith in God is, well, if you believe, first, that he is, that God actually exists. You believe that God exists. And then the second is that God is good. And I think the majority of the doubts, at least the conversations that I've had, the majority of these doubts fit in one of these two categories. Does God exist? And if he does, is he good? We must establish what our doubts are as specifically as you can. Do you doubt the existence of God? or maybe just the existence of God in the Bible, or maybe if He does exist, is He good? Does He care if we seek Him? Is He even involved in our lives today? These are important questions, and we need to consider them. You need to establish what that doubt is, but you also need to ask yourself, what kind of doubt is this? Is this one that is contingent on just more evidence? More of a logical-based one. One that if I just had this piece of evidence, then I would understand more. Like, is there enough proof to believe in God? Is there enough proof to trust the Bible? Or is it more of an emotional one? You just don't feel the way other Christians do. Or you don't feel the same way that other Christians do about God's goodness. Or you don't get the same emotional response that other people get when reading the Bible. And there's a certain level of doubt in there. But I think the other thing that we need to do in this category is we need to assess where these doubts come from. How did these doubts come about? Do you have doubts because you have come across some conflicting evidence, like some billion-year-old fossil or some crafty philosophical argument? Did you come across something and now suddenly you're taking a step back? Well, I don't know about that. Or were your doubts created when you went through something really hard? When there was a really difficult life situation, which is new evidence to some degree. You went through something really difficult. Or maybe you observed someone else going through something really difficult and that totally rocked your world and you didn't know how to respond to that. Or, and be honest with yourself, do your doubts come from peer pressure more than anything? And it's not necessarily something that's evidence-based. It's really just more you feel pressure to change or embarrassed to believe one thing or another. Or maybe you were treated poorly by other Christians. And that really bothered you. So, rather than having this pressure that's kind of pulling you out of faith, you're feeling this pressure from within pushing you out of faith. Either way, these doubts are being created. Or, do you have doubts really? Because you just want to live differently. You don't feel like living that restrictive Christian life anymore. And so these doubts come about and so you operate under that. We'll have more to say about that later. But you need to establish what your doubts are. And then secondly, once you've established those doubts, you need to address these doubts. You can't say you're struggling with something if you're not actually struggling with it. If you're not actually wrestling with it and trying to figure these things out. Says that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. Are you seeking answers? We have to try and find answers. Again, one of the main points that I want to drive home today, talk to someone if you're having doubts. Think about John the Baptist in Matthew 11 and Luke 7. He was in a pretty difficult situation. He was in prison, and he started to have some doubts. Which is crazy to think that John the Baptist had doubts as to who Jesus was. But rather than just sitting in prison, meditating to himself, wondering this question till his death, what he does is he sends his disciples out, hey, go to Jesus, ask him this question and report it back to me. He talked to somebody. We need to do some research. We need to try and find answers. In Acts chapter 17, we learn about the church in Berea. And when Paul comes to this church and he preaches something that's totally different, they have doubts in what they used to believe. And Paul starts quoting these scriptures. Well, what do? They search those scriptures to make sure that these things are true. So, if someone is showing you evidence that God does not exist or that God did not create the world, do some research. Look that stuff up. If someone is trying to show you that this doctrinal belief that you have been holding isn't actually true, it's actually this, well, search the scriptures that they show you if they're showing you any. Look at these things. We need to do some research. But as we talk and as we search, we need to do it sincerely. There's an interesting story in Luke chapter 1. You have Zacharias and you have Mary, both of whom are spoken to by an angel. And this angel says that something crazy is going to happen. Zacharias, you're going to have a child, even though you're really old. Mary, you're going to have a child, even though you're a virgin. And so they process this information and they both express doubt. They both ask the question, well, how can that be? However, Zacharias is punished by being made mute, while Mary, she's given an answer, which she believes. So what's the difference between the two? Well, if you continue reading in Luke chapter 1, the angel points out that Zacharias didn't actually believe. Not only that, Zacharias, the priest, by the way, did he have any evidence from God that God could make an old person have a child? Absolutely he did. And yet, his question is more, well, how can that be? So when we're posing questions, do you ask those questions because you want answers? Or are those questions really just statements of doubt? We need to address our doubts. But the last thing is, once you find answers, you need to change accordingly. You need to make a change. But really, this is for sure the most difficult part of the process, right? Because this question holds a lot of weight. We would like to think that this is really just a scientific exercise. What we've been talking about this morning is really just the scientific method, where we make these hypotheses, we express these doubts of some kind, we search for clues or answers to those doubts, and, well, if it was just a scientific method, then all we would do next is just act. We would change based on the evidence. But this is far from an academic exercise. We know that. These questions have deeply seated emotional consequences. And as much as you might be saying that, look, hey, all I want is truth, and once I find that truth, I'm going to act accordingly, it's hardly ever that simple. The truth is, at least with the majority of the people that Jesus interacts with, the problem was never whether there was enough proof to merit change. The problem was, do you actually want to change? And I don't want to offend by posing this question. I don't want to imply or undermine the seriousness of your doubts. But at the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves, are we actually willing to change? It's a better question asked at the beginning of this search, right? If I find answers, am I actually willing to change because of those, because of what I find? Because faith is much more a matter of the will than it is an academic exercise. Faith is a choice. And I think we see that in a few stories. Consider John chapter 6. You don't have to turn there. But in John chapter 6, Jesus has fed the 5,000. And by the end of the chapter, the majority of those 5,000 people that surround Jesus are walking away from him. And why do they do that? Was this because there just simply wasn't enough evidence for them to follow Jesus anymore? No. Jesus just fed 5,000 people with very little. And yet they still ask the question in the middle of that chapter, what then do you do for a sign so that we may see and believe you? So is a sign really what they needed? Is that what would have tipped them over the edge to follow Jesus? No. Clearly, that was not it. They chose not to believe. Consider Matthew 19 and Mark 10, the story of the rich young ruler. This man comes to Jesus because he recognizes that Jesus is a good teacher. And it's interesting that Jesus actually points out in Mark, no one is good but God, almost saying, like, you realize what you're calling me by calling me a good teacher, right? And he comes to him. He kneels before him, showing him honor and respect. And he asks Jesus, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus gives him an answer. But it wasn't what he wanted to hear. It was not the answer that suited him. And so he chose to not have faith. He chose to walk away sorrowfully. I want to pause here. Not everyone who leaves Jesus skipping and jumping, happy that they now get to live whatever life they want to do. Some people leave Jesus extremely sorrowfully. But his will trumped the truth. His will was stronger than the truth that Jesus provided. Can you relate to that at all? We know a lot of things that we should do. And how often do we do the exact opposite? Because we just want to. Lastly, consider John chapter 20 and the aptly named Doubting Thomas. Thomas doubts, and he makes that doubt very clear. I do not believe that Jesus rose from the dead, and I will not believe unless I see the scars in his hands and his feet and I touch his side. And that's something that Jesus is very critical of, the fact that he was not willing to believe at the beginning. But to Thomas's credit, when he is given that evidence, when Jesus shows him his hands and has him touch his side, what does Thomas say? My Lord and my God. Earlier in the book of John, Thomas says that I'm willing to die with you. Let's go to Jerusalem. Well, after he sees the risen Lord, he is willing to declare that Jesus is Lord. Thomas changes because of the evidence. I want to quickly address these 3 points by taking a look at 2 different stories. That the gospel accounts pose. First, I want to look at the Pharisees. In John chapter 10, go ahead and turn there. In John chapter 10, you see the Pharisees doubting. It's not the first time they've doubted. For some time, they had doubted what people said about Jesus. Back in chapter 7, they're arguing, is Jesus a good man? And at the end of chapter 7, they're arguing, is he the Christ? And then in the middle of chapter 10, they're asking, well, does he have a demon? They're arguing. There's this division among them as to who Jesus really is. But certainly the Pharisees fit on the side of doubt, even though, and it's kind of strange, in John chapter 8, they seem to believe to some degree. But then by the end of that, they certainly show some doubts that he's the Christ. But in verse 24, they make their doubts pretty clear. Is Jesus really the Christ? And to their credit, they address those doubts, right? They go right to Jesus and they ask him, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. But it's pretty clear that that question does not come from a sincere heart, because they've already ignored the evidence. Again, earlier in John 7, they go to the scripture to see if this man really is the Christ. And they conclude, well, he can't be the Christ because he's not from Bethlehem. We know where he's from. He's from Nazareth. Well, would it have taken the Pharisees too much work to figure out really where he was from? Well, no, but of course, they make no such attempt. In fact, it seems as though they are only asking Jesus this question in John 10. At best, it's to appease the accusation of Nicodemus earlier in chapter 7. When Nicodemus says, you know, the law talks about when you're going to accuse someone, you actually need to go to that person and talk to them. And so maybe they're going because of that. But it seems more likely that they're just asking Jesus this question to entrap him, just to get more evidence so that we can kill him. And so do the Pharisees change? Of course not, because they had no intent to change, only to entrench themselves further in what their hearts had already decided. But if the Pharisees are a negative example, I think Peter certainly serves as a positive example. Even though Peter certainly shows some examples of a lack of faith in some parts. In Luke chapter 24, after the women go to the tomb and are spoken to by these angels who say that Jesus has risen from the dead, these women go back and they report these things to the disciples. And what do the disciples do? Well, they don't believe it. His words are like utter nonsense to them. And so Peter's doubt is, did Jesus really rise from the dead? Well, how does Peter address that doubt? What does Peter do in verse 12? He runs to the tomb. When Peter has doubts as to whether Jesus really rose from the dead or not, he runs to the tomb. If we only saw our doubts as pressing as Peter saw his, I mean, this should be a metaphor for our own lives. When we have doubts in anything, hey, run to the tomb. Go find answers. And he does it. And when Peter got his answer, when he saw the empty tomb, Peter's life is changed. But it's interesting. In John's account of this story, John seems to indicate, but he believed, but he didn't really understand everything. So, because Peter didn't understand everything, does that mean he still has to live in a world where Jesus has not risen? Of course not. He doesn't know everything, but he still acts upon the things that he does know. Jesus has risen, and what Peter shows in the book of Acts is a totally changed man. Now, it's true that our doubts might not be met with the amount of sight, with the amount of certainty as the apostles here. I understand that. However, Jesus calls those who do not see, but believe the testimony of those who did see, Jesus calls them blessed. He makes clear that faith or belief is possible even without sight. We read that in Hebrews 11, as we read earlier, but Paul also affirms this in 2 Corinthians 5. We walk by faith, not by sight. Lastly, and I promise quickly, I want to address those who are more on this side of things, have stronger faith. There's three things that I would like you to do. The first is that you too need to continue seeking God. Do not stop seeking God. Hebrews 11 and verse 6 says that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. That's in context of people who already have faith. If you have faith, strong faith, continue to seek God. Seeking God not only serves as an answer to our doubts, but it's this preventative measure to prevent doubts from coming. I'm reminded of the story of Peter when he's walking on the water in Matthew 14. Peter had faith. He had heard Jesus teach. He'd seen Jesus do miracles. He saw Jesus even walking on the water. He even says, "Hey, Jesus, tell me to come out on the water." And now he's walking. And yet he starts to sink. Why? Well, the winds and the waves caused him to lose sight of Jesus. He stopped looking at Jesus. We must continue to seek God. But we must also be willing to tell others why we believe. Specifically, for this lesson, we need to tell those who are doubting why we believe. 1 Peter 3 and verse 15 says, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." An account for the hope that is in you. What is the foundation of that hope? But faith. We must be willing to speak to others about our faith. And it's not just those who have no faith at all or have no idea what the Bible is. Sure, we need to tell them, but we also need to tell that 40-year-old who has been sitting on these pews every Sunday and Wednesday, who should know these things by now, and yet is still doubting. We need to reveal our faith to them. But how? But with gentleness and reverence. We must create an environment for change. Essentially, we can't ridicule people for having doubts. Say what you want to about my generation and the generations that come after me. You can call these generations soft or fragile, and really I'm not going to argue against that in many respects. However, and I think what I'm about to say is true for pretty much all generations. However, if you think, well, I'll say it this way. I can assure you that you're not going to get anywhere with them who are doubting if you embarrass them for having doubts. You are not going to get anywhere in shaming people for having doubts, whether they've been here forever or are new to the faith. We have to create an environment for change. Now, this is something that we certainly need to address within the church, but I think especially in the home. Moms and dads, what are we doing? Are we establishing a level of trust with our kids that they can express doubts? They can express these doubts with an understanding that they are not going to be shamed or embarrassed because of them. By the way, even if we are a little ashamed or embarrassed over their doubts, but also an environment in which moms and dads are prepared to give answers. And we have to be able and willing to do so with this gentleness and reverence. I want to end by looking at Ephesians chapter 4. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, he says, "Therefore I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing tolerance for one another in love, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as also you were called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all." You may be in the audience now, or perhaps listening at home or later. You may be in this category, verses 4 through 6, where you doubt these things. You're not sure if there is one God or even a God. You're not sure there is one Lord or one faith. Maybe there's multiple ways to get to God. My plea for you is that you would look for answers, and that you wouldn't just sit there in those doubts. But for those of you who are strong in the faith, I want to highlight verses 2 and 3. How are we going to speak to people? But with humility, gentleness, with patience, showing tolerance for one another in love. Because we want to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. Bearing in mind the example of Christ, who shows His patience with us despite our many times of unbelief. I invite everyone here today who has doubts to confess those doubts to someone. Maybe you need to publicly do it in some respect. And if you feel compelled to do that, then I'm about to give an invitation. We're going to sing a song, actually. And during that song, you are welcome to come up to the front and sit down. Someone will sit down and speak with you, and you can express those doubts. I hope that you find this place a comfortable environment to do so, but if it's not, I hope that you will find someone that you can speak to. However, if you're past doubts, and you're to the point where you know you need to act, now is the time to do it. Again, run to the tomb. Run to Jesus. Whether you need to confess some sort of sin in your life, or whether you want to become a Christian and be baptized right now, again, this invitation is for you. While we sing, you can come up to the front and we can have you baptized this very morning. If you have need of either one of those invitations, please come up now while we stand and sing.